I didn't realise just how much inspiration I had taken from this book until I reread it and went, oh, well, it wasn't plagiarism.
Just check with my lawyer. Nope, nope, not plagiarism. Inspiration. What did we say we were going to talk about?
God, I don't know. My mental health's on fire. That's fun.
Oh, yeah, yeah, that's right. How's that?
It's actually, no, it's not so bad today. I worked out where I was treating myself badly and started being a bit gentler with myself. Like,
can you reveal?
Oh, no, just things like, so for 2 weeks of, so for listeners, we're recording this over a week before it comes out because we're trying to be efficient.
Yeah, we did that for a while at the start of the podcast and we're...
At one point we were a month ahead.
Yeah, I didn't care for that.
No, it didn't really work. So we're just coming to the end of lockdown 2, Electric Boogaloo. And yeah, for 2 weeks of it, I like really intensely worked on the web development course I was doing and was very proud of myself for that. And then I've kind of realized this week, like, making myself do that much work every day was actually not helping me because I was beating myself up if I couldn't get through like 4 units a day. And that probably hasn't helped with my brain. So I'm just being a bit gentler with myself.
Yeah, well, you're going back to work next week anyway, aren't you? So
yeah.
So rest a little bit first.
Yes, I'm giving myself a little exhale weekend.
Yeah, done very well, though. You've learned HTML and CSS and started the awful void that is JavaScript.
Oh, I've been doing, what was I doing? Like Axios and async functions and... I'm learning about APIs and my head hurts just a lot. I have a very sore brain. But yeah, so not saying my mental health is shaky, but that TikTok of the guy dancing to Ra Ra Rasputin has... I've watched it probably more times than is healthy.
I think that's a kind of universal good, though, that video.
Yeah, I'm like...
I would highly distrust anyone who disliked it.
Yeah, but there's liking it and there's watching it 18 times.
Yeah.
Which is not the number of times I've watched it. or there's liking it and there's looking at cowboy boots on eBay because I want to try and reenact it. I'm not doing that.
Well, you made me watch Hamilton and then I bought jodhpurs, so I really can't judge.
Yes, but the jodhpurs really suit you.
I need boots. Well, I have boots to go with them, actually, but they're my walking boots, so I can't wear the jodhpurs anywhere but on dog walks. Which is fine. I mean, where am I going to wear jodhpurs?
Well, yeah, it's not like you go horse riding.
Yeah. Yeah, part of the mental health thing, I really like that article you sent me on the cooking fatigue.
Oh,
I really liked it. I felt seen.
Yeah, the Helen Reznor one. We'll link to this in the show notes. And it was just a really, she's an amazing food writer. She's one of my favourites and the entire reason I've considered a subscription to The New Yorker. Hmm. But she wrote about how she's just sick of food and cooking and making meals and thinking about it every day in the weird COVID times because it is fatiguing. Even if, and I fucking love food and cooking. It is my favorite thing. And even I'm sick of it.
Yeah. Yeah. You started on a much higher baseline than I did of tolerance for having to cook nice meals.
Yeah.
I'm just, a few weeks ago I just hit a wall on it. I was like, Jack, I can't cook this week.
Yeah.
And Jack, for listeners, is not some horrible 50s husband. He just works far, far, far more hours than I do, so I don't mind cooking. But yeah, I was like, yeah, we're getting takeaway for a week. Sorry, dude.
Yeah, that's fair. I actually, to be fair, as much as I'm sick of it, I am cooking with, because it's a Saturday today, I'm going to cook myself a very delicious dinner tonight and I'm very excited.
What is it?
Well, so because Waitrose fucked up and sent me ribeye steaks instead of short ribs, I am having steak with a parsnip and potato rosti and a nice red wine sauce and some Cavolet Nero and chestnut mushrooms.
May I gently suggest this kind of thing is why you've got cooking fatigue?
Yeah. Like the other day I was
going to have fish and chips.
The other day I was, we went for a walk together and then I was really tired and I was like, oh God, I can't be asked to cook anything wanky. I'm just going to make myself a lazy pasta thing. So I defrosted a salmon fillet and had a salmon mascarpone and caramelized fennel pasta. And I am just really bad at like
lazy cooking. That sounds fancy, but I could make that, which means it's your kind of lazy cooking. So
although
I can stir mascarpone, I can caramelize fennel, I can defrost salmon.
Yes. I get great.
That's a lie. I usually just stick it in the instant pot because I forget to defrost it.
I would do that if I had an instant pot. I get groceries delivered like once every couple of weeks, and I have taken to normally on a Sunday, because that's sort of my day off. I've taken to putting an oven pizza in my grocery delivery. So once every 2 weeks, I have a little lazy Sunday night where I have an oven pizza in a bit.
Ooh. Do you have a favorite?
I sound like such a posh wanker, but Waitrose do this like mushroom mascarpone one.
Yeah, I love that. Yeah. I like the feta or something and caramelized onions one they do as well. Ricotta, yeah, I think.
They don't do my favorite garlic bread anymore, and that makes me really sad. They used to do a really nice roasted garlic flatbread.
Oh, yeah. Do they not do that?
Well, I haven't seen it on the website. I also started my Christmas grocery order, which basically means I've just ordered 7 kinds of cheese and 2 bowls of champagne.
Sweet.
Oh, and a leg of mutton, but that's coming from a butcher.
Good.
So if our listeners weren't aware, I am a colossal wanker.
No, mutton's not wanky food. Mutton's good salt of the earth food, isn't it?
The way I'm going to cook it.
What's the other one? There's lamb, there's mutton, and what's the old one called?
Hogget.
Hogget, yeah, I had that once.
Hogget's nice. Hogget's younger than mutton, I think.
Oh, is it?
Yeah, I think hogget's, so lamb is if it's less than a year old, and then hogget's if it's a year or above, and then mutton is like 2 years or above, I want to say.
Okay.
I might have those the wrong way around.
Get chunks of sheep brought home from the farm, so.
That happens to the best of us.
Yeah. And I go by how they smell, obviously, as I don't eat them, but that smelled very nice when I made it, interest you.
I once, in a kitchen I worked in, had a whole hogget unexpectedly delivered one morning and had to wrestle it down into
the hogget, an unexpected delivery.
Oh, we're starting the Lord of the Rings references early then.
Oh, yes.
So, yes, that was a strange morning in my life, especially as I was very hungover.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Right. As we have things to do later...
Shall we
grab a coffee and then think about...
Should we make a podcast?
Yeah, no, I think we should.
Excellent.
That sounds like a sound plan.
Okay.
If it fits in with your self-care routine.
Making a podcast is self-care.
Okay.
Hello and welcome to The Truth Shall Make You Fret, a podcast in which we're reading and recapping every book from Terry Pratchett's Discworld series, one at a time in chronological order. I'm Joanna Hagen.
And I'm Francine Carroll.
And this is part one of our discussion of Witches Abroad.
Hell yes.
Although for some reason I wrote Weird Sisters in the show plan. I'm going to make that mistake a lot and I don't know why.
Well, you did, didn't you? Well, I didn't notice it either, so that's fine.
Excellent. Note on spoilers before we get started. This is a spoiler light podcast. Obviously, heavy spoilers for the book we're on, Witches Abroad. But we will avoid spoiling any major future events in the Discworld series, and we're saving any and all discussion of the final Discworld book, The Shepherd's Crown, until we get there, so you, dear listener, can come on the journey with us.
A journey on kind of broomsticks of questionable quality, and hopefully not over too many waterfalls.
Not too many waterfalls. Bit of follow-up, some dispatches from the round world. Some people have been lovely on Reddit, including...
Which is an announcement in itself, isn't it?
Yeah. Dungeon Master said something lovely about reaching out to us and referred to us as Glorious Hosts, which, just if anyone's listening, we like that as a nickname, if you want to pick that up.
Glorious is a nice adjective.
Mad Joe, who is not me, pointed out that Vermeen were first mentioned in the first Witches book, Weird Sisters. So,
Weird Sisters? Or Eat Chorus?
Well, no, because it was first Witches book, it was Margaret who was wondering about them.
Quite right, yes. See, I know that. I read that the other day, for God's sake.
Yep. And Kate said she really liked the term Grief Sherpa. Shout out to Kate. A couple of people have offered to be historical researchers and PhD researchers for us, and we can pay... I shared something on Twitter about You're Dead to Me, which I've talked about a lot. It's one of my favourite history podcasts, and their research process. Obviously, theirs involves like 6 PhD students. Ours involves us Googling things and normally linking to a Wikipedia page.
I have many arcane books, I'll have you know. It's just harder to link to in the show notes.
I normally end up consulting brewers at least once a book. and we got a lovely email from Stephen. Hi, Stephen, who has promised to send us some traditional Australian cinema snacks via Albatross, including the Choc Top and the Fantal. I'm not sure if I'm saying Fantal right. I don't know if it's Fantali.
I don't think I ever tried Australian cinema snacks. That's very exciting.
So the Choc Top is like a Mr. Whippy. From what the links he sent us, the Choc Top is like a Mr. Whippy, but with like a hard shell of chocolate on top. So I'm very into this.
Have you ever had... No, you wouldn't have because you've not read. My favourite Australian ice cream was the Golden Gay Time, which is really called that, and which is just as good as the name suggests.
I am just not going to say anything.
But you're allowed.
As the resident podcast queer, I am.
I set you up. I'm not allowed to make jokes.
Look, I'd love a Golden Gay Time, but unfortunately there's a pandemic.
There we go.
And Fantals, Fantalis, whatever they are like little chocolate-covered caramels that come in a bag, so I want to try those. Cool, thank you, Stephen. Cool. He also pointed out, been thinking about Wendell Poons being such a different character in Reaper Man once he's dead.
Mm.
And thinking about what Mark Burrows said about how sort of Victor and Tepic are all this one character. He says, Wendell Poons almost seems like an undead version of that, although he's obviously not young. My favourite part of Stephen's email, I wonder whether these characters represent the reader, since they often seem to be a bit bewildered by what's going on, get thrust into a role they didn't ask for, and need to have things to explain to them. Which is quite a lovely way to look at it and think about it.
I think that's definitely got legs, because in the early, early books, I would say that kind of Rincewind and Twoflower switched places in that role.
Yeah.
And then perhaps equal rights, it was Granny Weatherwax. But yeah, no, I'd say... It's the straight man trope, isn't it? I agree.
So, yes, I enjoyed that email. Thank you, Stephen. And I think that's all my dispatches from the round world. So shall we crack on? Would you like to introduce us to the book Witches Abroad, Francine?
Sure. I like Witches Abroad. It was published in November 1991 because Terry Pratchett was just insanely prolific, really quite offensive. Witches Abroad is the 12th Discworld novel and the third in the Witches arc, or the second proper Witches book, you could say, because it's got Nanny and Magrat and the more powerful version of Granny, because it was kind of toned down a lot in equal rights. The title is, of course, a pun or a play on words. Our titular witches are both abroad in foreign parts and abroad at large. I'd say overall it's like a more cohesive story than Reaper Man. So the comedy and the tragedy, it's got that same balance, but it's in the same plot line.
Yeah, there's no real B-plot to this.
Yeah.
I suppose some of the events in Genua are a bit B-plotty, but it all comes together very quickly.
Yeah, I mean, by part three, all of the B-plots are...
Yeah, it's all...
With the A-plots making an ab-plot.
Ab-plot. That is definitely a proper writing term.
As I was saying it, I realised that was not something I should say. So when it was released, it seemed to have some... positive reviews. I found one I particularly liked. Steve Green writing in Critical Wave with limited foresight. Witches Abroad proves there's still a little mileage left in the Discworld mythos. It was adapted for stage. Did you know that?
Yes, I haven't seen any adaptation. Quite a lot of them have been adapted in various ways.
It was by the What You Call Them Players in 97 was the one I was reading about because Pratchett recommended it.
Nice.
Because he went twice to the performance of Lords and Ladies, paying the second time. He liked it so much. So.
Wow.
If only I could travel back to 1997, I would indeed take that recommendation.
Yep, I would travel back to 1997. Provided
if anybody has a VHS tape or similar, please albatross it over.
I mean, do either of us have VHS players?
I would get one to watch that.
Actually, yeah, I definitely would. This is a really exciting one for me to talk about because I've talked about my Discworld origin story on the podcast various times where I sort of read them all out of order because I'd read Amazing Morris as a kid and then I started picking them up. And the first one I picked up was Soul Music because someone recommended it because I really like the Blues Brothers.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next one I picked up, because I was dating someone who had all the books and so I was just grabbing ones that looked interesting off the shelf, was this one. So I read this before I read Weird Sisters or Equal Rights. This was my first introduction to the witches.
And the good thing is it really doesn't matter.
They do all sort of stand up and stand alone and do what they need to do. And
Especially this one as compared to the other witches ones, because none of what happened in Weird Sisters really impacts this, apart from perhaps the three witches are more friends than they would have been at the start.
yeah, I think Weird Sisters establishes the dynamic quite well, but
yeah,
you don't need to have read that to see the dynamic in this. It's very well written as an individual story.
Yeah, for sure.
It was interesting going back and rereading it later on once I had the context of the previous books.
Yeah.
Because I understood a bit more about Margaret, but...
Yeah. Right. Do you want to summarise then and we'll get into it?
Yeah. So in this section of the book, which goes up to page 87 in the Corgi paperback, we begin with the turtle Chaos and the nature of stories. In a far-off swamp, gods are made as a hat, coat and mirror affixed to a stake. On a bare mountain, witches meet. We witness Desiderata Hollow's last moments as she confronts the mysterious Lilith in the mirror and provides Death with some handy exposition about how stories work. Lady Lilith de Temsir stands between her mirrors, while on the mountain, the witches gathered for the sabbat complain about the lack of new blood. Granny and Nanny agree to check in on Desiderata's cottage, where Albert Herker has just collected a mysterious package for delivery. In the morning, Granny and Nanny search the cottage for a mysterious something, and a mirror meets its fate. Meanwhile, Margaret, in search of herself, has her martial arts practice interrupted by a special delivery from Herker. Wondering what to do with the magic wand and the not-so-helpful letter from Desiderata, she goes to the cottage and, of course, happens upon Granny and Nanny, who learn that Margaret is now a fairy godmother and must go to Genua and stop someone from marrying a prince. Of course, they offer to lend their considerable expertise to the endeavour. The ragtag bunch of magical mavens set off on their broomsticks for Genua, Nanny in fetching new red boots and a specially reinforced hat, and Margaret terrifyingly bifurcated. We learn about the nature of mirrors and magic as Margaret, Nanny and Granny continue on with their journey. Trapped in a frozen mountain pass, they find themselves seeking assistance from dwarfs and helping in return with a terrifying mind collapse. Margaret's magic wand skills leave something to be desired, but the pumpkin transformation frees the dwarfs and the gang head off on their merry way in a handy little boat. A waterfall nearly takes out the intrepid travellers, but Pumpkin saved the day once more. Lily keeps an eye on the gang with her mirror magic and chats mystical exposition with the complaining Duke. In a royal audience, the Duke and Lilith punish a toy maker for crimes against narrative. Mrs. Pleasant, the palace cook, goes to visit her good friend Mrs. Gogol in the swamp. Gogol invites Mrs. Pleasant to watch for witches. Margaret, Nanny and Granny get lost in a gothic forest before making their way to a mysteriously garlicky town. Strangely, after Gribo eats a bat, the town is a much happier place. And after an Oompa celebration, Nanny invents the postcard and the witches fly on. So helicopter and loincloth watch, broomsticks are performing the duty of helicopters for this section.
Sure.
Other things that we've been sort of keeping track on, we open on the turtle again, and Death is around.
Yes, a little later. We'll see. Oh, no, we've seen him already, haven't we? Yes,
we have seen him. We've seen him with Desiderata.
Yes.
So we haven't had a book without Death yet. But, so far, not been to Ankh-Morpork.
Oh, yeah. Huh. Yes. It has been mentioned.
Yes.
But that's as far as it's gone, yeah.
So, quotes. Your favourite quote is definitely before mine.
Yeah, it's right at the beginning. I rather liked Pratchett's... Pratchett clearly kind of had a bit of a rant inside him that he just needed to get out with a tenuous connection to what we're on about. talking about scientists who used to learn for... look for little bits of gold knowledge amongst gravel of uncertainty and such forth. But the trouble was that ignorance became more interesting, especially big, fascinating ignorance about huge and important things like matter and creation. And people stopped patiently building their little houses of rational sticks in the chaos of the universe and started getting interested in the chaos itself, partly because it was a lot easier to be an expert on chaos, but mostly because it made really good patterns that you could put on a t-shirt.
I like that bit.
Yes, he kind of seems to share my... slight horror and fascination with that whole area of physics that I will never be able to grasp.
That was something I think I had a similar thing as one of my favorite quotes from Equal Rights, which is a conversation after young Simon has taught a class at the university. All the wizards are going, well, now I'm very confused about the big fundamental important things about the universe, which makes me very superior to people who are only confused about little things.
Exactly so, yes.
Yes, I enjoy Pratchett brings that up quite a few times and is always quite scathing about it.
Yes, while at the same time clearly having a fondness for it.
Yeah.
God.
Okay, yeah, so mine
is right near the end.
Yeah, mine's right near the end of the section. Most people on waking up accelerate through a quick panicky pre-consciousness checkup. Who am I? Where am I? Who is he? She? Good God, why am I cuddling a policeman's helmet? What happened last night? And this is because people are riddled by doubt. It is the engine that drives them through their lives. It is the elastic band in the little model aeroplane of their soul, and they spend their time winding it up until it knots. Early morning is the worst time. There's that little moment of panic in case you have drifted away in the night and someone else has moved in. This never happened to Granny Weatherwax. She went straight from fast asleep to instant operation on all six cylinders. She never needed to find herself because she always knew who was doing the looking.
Wouldn't that be nice?
Yeah, speaking as someone who always, like, I very rarely, even minus the pandemic, have the sort of morning where I wake up and go, oh God, where am I? Who's that? Why have I got this?
Yeah.
But even so, I still tend to wake up in a bit of a panic.
Yeah, just general background panic. Rinse Windesk.
Yeah. Oh God, should the I universe. Be
running? Yes.
What is this?
And yeah, then I go it's a very back to nice sleep. Way to kind of summarise Granny's self-possessed nature.
Yes.
So going on to characters.
Yes. I thought we'd start with our lovely Desiderata Hollow.
Mm-hmm. Is that how we're saying it? Desiderata. Yes. That makes sense. Cool.
I like that she was given the advice of never trust a dog with orange eyebrows, always get the young man's name and address, never get between two mirrors, and always wear clean underwear every day because you never know when you're going to be knocked down and killed by a runaway horse. And if people found you had unsatisfactory underwear on, you'd die of shame.
Quite.
But luckily she's become a witch, knows exactly when she's going to die and can wear whatever underwear she likes.
Exactly. Do you have a pair that you would definitely wear?
I don't know. Like, what kind of underwear do you want to be wearing when you die? Like, do you want it to be pretty or just really comfy or, like...
I think probably a mix between the both. Like,
yeah, like I wouldn't want
granny
to be wearing
pants, but like I don't want to be dying in lingerie. So
yeah, I want something that's like going to be comfy if it comes with me to the afterlife and doesn't have any holes in.
Like seamless, black, decent shape.
I have some really pretty like 50s style high-waisted ones, actually. I think that would be a good choice.
Cool.
Anyway,
glad we got that sorted.
Yeah, that was the important thing. I like Desiderata for someone who's only actually in the book for a few pages. She's got that witchy confidence that Pratchett writes very well. There's a really lovely line about her. She says that Lilith has a bee in her bonnet about it.
Mm-hmm.
That she was not someone to use extreme language, but it was possible to be sure that when she deployed a mild term like a bee in her bonnet, she was using it to define someone whom she believed to be several miles over the madness horizon and accelerating. I love people who can do that, who can use such a mild term and make it sound much worse than any big sweary insult.
Yes, definitely. I think we've got a couple of friends who could do that. One of our American friends, Tiffany, I think.
Oh, yeah, she is the sweetest.
I would add more weight to her words than most people's.
She was the sort of sweetest, most good-natured person. And if she ever sort of said, well, I don't care for that, while quietly taking a sip of her tea, that was...
Oh, gosh.
Everyone would clutch the pearls. The pub would go quiet. Oh, I miss those people.
I really miss Diane Tiffany.
Mm. So there's an interesting bit in Desiderata's where she sort of talks about the nature of fairy godmothering and the fact that there has to be two of them.
Yeah, it's a mirror.
Yeah.
Mirror image rather than the usual trio.
Yeah, which I quite like it as adding to the mythos within this book.
It's never explained, is it, how Desiderata ends up being a fairy godmother. One can assume that Lilith sought it out.
Yeah. Assume Desiderata became a fairy godmother in a very similar way to how she makes Margaret a fairy godmother.
Oh, someone went, you'll go.
Yep. So... sticking with the witches, obviously we have the Sabbat on the mountaintop. Mother Dismas makes me giggle.
Oh, she's great. We used to have one of those, but the bit you unscrew fell off and we lost it.
Temporally unfocused. So you just sort of say things and hope at some point she passes through and catches them.
It does remind me of our conversations if we try and talk when we're too tired.
Yeah, there are wild disconnects.
That hoping eventually we'll kind of fix on to what the other one's saying.
Note some of our early podcast episodes.
Yes.
Then who else? Obviously, Nanny Og is here. We love Nanny Og. She's still
Nanny
my favourite.
Best.
I like that as they're all sat there having this very serious conversation about, you know, not having enough young witches, Nanny Og is just throwing in, anyone bring any marshmallows?
Yeah, it's like this may be the end of witchcraft in these parts.
Cup of tea?
Oh, I could do with a snack.
Yeah. There's also, alongside Nanny Og, there's a more thorough description of the Og clan.
Oh, yes. One of your favourite what's it? Is it a trope even?
I don't know. A device?
Yeah, let's call it a device. Devices. Yeah.
The Ogs were what is known as an extended family. In fact, not only extended, but elongated, protracted, and persistent. No normal sheet of paper could possibly trace their family tree, which in any case was more like a mangrove thicket. And every single branch had a low-key chronic vendetta against every other branch based on such well-established causality as what their Kevin said about our Stan at our cousin Di's wedding. Who got the silver cut tree that Auntie Em promised our Doreen was to have after she died? I'd like to know. Thank you very much, if you don't mind.
All capitalised.
Yeah. And I love this idea of Nanny Ogg as this matriarch of this whole clan just randomly encourages the fights for shits and giggles.
Yeah, it makes you wonder, like, whether she took a more active, petty role as she was growing up and just kind of grew into this position, or whether she's always had the knack for it.
I would say she's probably always, because she's a witch, yeah. I think she's always had the knack for it.
I reckon, yeah.
Especially yeah. She, it's down to her that the clan is so large in some ways, I'm assuming.
Yeah.
I don't think we actually get an explanation of how many children or she's had, or how many husbands she's had.
Several.
Many. And then, obviously, one of our all-time faves, Granny Weatherwax.
Hooray.
Love her.
Star of the show.
Absolute star of the show. One of my favourite moments of hers is when... So Margaret has turned up, has been given this note from Desiderata saying, whatever you do, don't let her get involved.
Interfering old Besom or something.
Yes. And obviously that's because she wants Nanny to get, that's because she wants Granny to get involved, and that's the best way. There's a moment where Margaret turns up and Nanny and Granny reads the note that says, don't let her get involved.
Yeah.
And you can see it almost get knocked briefly a tiny bit off her axis. And then immediately she says, no. So Desiderata says we're supposed to help Margaret. And Margaret kind of just goes, yeah, all right.
That seems like an argument that is going to be more trouble than just going with you. Okay. It's amazing because, like, maybe it's a bit deeper than it looks, but Granny Weatherwax and Nanny Ogg both have, you know, fantastic knowledge of headology, and they can work in incredibly complicated psychological tricks on everyone else, but the basic reverse psychology works perfectly on them every time.
They are both their own blind spots.
Yeah.
And yes. I think that's really good. You, the relationship between Nanny and Granny as well.
Oh, yeah. I thought it was almost summed up by the introduction, which was, and Granny really couldn't be having it all with Nanny Ogg, who was her best friend. But, like, in the cottage, their interactions in there are fantastic. And then
just the constant little bickering.
Exactly. But they've been at odds, and then suddenly they're on the same team when it comes to bullying Margaret into giving the wand over.
Yeah.
And then sharing a bed. And, like, are you wearing your boots? Are you eating garlic sausage?
I feel like this is what our friendship will be as we get older.
It is definitely goals. Squad goals.
Right, yeah, so Nanny and Granny's squad goals. I don't think either of us have ever said squad goals out loud before, and I don't think we ever should again.
No, I don't regret it, but I shan't be revisiting it.
Yeah.
So Margaret.
So yes, third part. So
putting Margaret, the focus on someone even more embarrassing than me.
Margaret is not attending the Sabbat because she's busy finding herself.
Yes.
For those wondering what was sort of going on after the events of Weird Sisters, she's decided not to get married to the king because she refuses to be a sex object. There's one of my favourite Granny and Nanny little interactions is, I'm pleased to say I don't even know what a sex object is, said Granny Weatherwax firmly. I do, said Nanny Ogg. I like the, we've talked about the inspiration particles on the podcast before, and Margaret is one of those people who has such an open mind that they all sort of turn up.
Another one of these recurring concepts.
She also just gets a little throwaway line that I love, which is when she's delivered the magic wand and Herka says, well, I was told you give me a penny. And she just very calmly says, oh, yes, money forges the chains which bind the labouring class, as she hands it over.
Yeah, such a twat.
We all know someone who's a bit like that, though.
Yeah.
Usually.
Like, yes, but just give the man a penny for what he's done, please.
So, yes. She makes... I love her. I have such sympathy for her because I think we've all been that person who's had a moment of, right, no, I must find myself.
Oh, yeah, many of them. I wonder what would happen if she ever met Two Flower.
Dithering.
So much dithering. But the inspiration particles, Joanna.
They would just dither.
Oh, Jason.
R. Jason, bless R. Jason. R. Jason is one of Nanny Ogg's sons. Apparently, he doesn't look as if he could have been born, but as if he must have been constructed in a shipyard. So he's the town blacksmith,
yeah,
and farrier.
Known particularly for his skills with awkward
horses.
Well,
he knows
horses.
The horseman's word, which is actually just him threatening to slam the balls on an anvil, but apparently it works.
Well, it would, wouldn't it, if you could get it across somehow.
It's very sweet when Nanny's saying, oh, I'm probably going to make my fortune when I go away, and you won't have to go to the forge ever again, but I like it. And then obviously Grebo's here. We love Grebo, the cat.
Going to massive softies.
Yes, he's an old softie, really.
He will come back with renewed vigour. Well, he plays a heroic part in this part, doesn't he? He kills the vampire.
Yes, unknowingly.
Unknowingly, but still, you can be an accidental hero, I think.
Yep. And then obviously the bigger one, Lady Lilith de Temsia. Is it a spoiler to say the villain of the piece? She's quite clearly villainous, isn't she?
Yeah, I think from moment one she is. I looked at the first name because I knew that Lilith was Adam's first wife before Eve. And when Adam wanted her to be the good subservient wife, Lilith grew wings and flew away.
Yes, the Lilith myth is really fascinating.
Yeah. But apparently it probably came from even older stories. So it was a Babylonian seductive demoness called Lilitu that she was probably based on originally. So.
Yeah, interesting.
It's a good name.
Mm. But yeah, and she's...
not her name.
She's an interesting character. She thinks a wishy-washy overgrown girl more suited to the attentions of a fairy godmother than being one, a little old washerwoman type who got drunk and sang songs, and the other one.
Yes.
And Lilith is obviously very big into this evil mirror magic, expanding her powers. The Duke... So the I'm duck. Saying... Yeah, I... Is it meant to be Duck or Duke?
I think, given all the wordplay, it's meant to be Duck.
Okay, I'm going to say Duke because I refuse to just say Duck that many times in this podcast.
Okay, fine.
So he is very handsome but has to wear smoked glasses because we can't really do anything about his eyes.
Yes.
And he is very whiny.
Isn't he, though? God.
He is. So he is. So Lilith is obviously the, what's it, the eminent Grace.
Yes.
To the ducks ruling over Genua. And then we've got Mrs. Pleasant, the palace cook.
Who's a very stereotypical cook, flowery arms and all.
Yep.
Because she has to be.
She took great care to bustle and stays fat and is luckily
Naturally... Yes, Lilith is very obviously the villain because she's cutting off people's heads for imprisoning them for being the wrong kind of toy maker.
For crimes against narrative.
Yes, yeah.
Where else are we? Yeah, so Mrs. Pleasant takes care to say things like lorks.
Oh, yes.
And then we obviously, with her, we meet Mrs. Gogol, who's obviously a witch of this particular area.
Yeah. Makes a damn good gumbo.
Yep. Yeah. And spots
you ever
the
had gumbo?
I have. I like gumbo and jambalaya.
I haven't. I want it. I've had jambalaya.
This book is why I ended up looking up flights to New Orleans. but yes, it's the future. She spotted in a bowl of jambalaya, but she pretended it was happening in the gumbo. I'm not going to try and imitate any of the accents between the two of them because our listeners just don't deserve that.
No, I think I don't think we could do that any justice or in any way that wasn't incredibly problematic. So
exactly. So I'm going to wait and talk about both
don't
of them.
Don't at us. It's so important.
So I'm going to wait and talk about them a bit more when we get on to the next section.
Yeah.
Because they have a lot more to do here. But they're keeping an eye out for the witches.
Yeah.
And then last little character moment I want to mention. This made me very excited. For all of you who remember that during Moving Pictures, I became a very big fan of Mrs. Cosmopolite.
Mm-hmm.
She gets a mention.
Yay!
Because everyone, determined seekers after wisdom, know where they... No matter where they happen to be, they'll always seek that wisdom, which is a long way off, because wisdom is one of the things that looks bigger the further away it is. So there is a sect of people who follow the way of Mrs. Cosmopolite. They've developed a special branch of martial arts based on their experiences, where they shout incomprehensibly at one another and then hit their opponent with a broom.
Perfect. I don't see any problem with this.
I am very happy for Mrs. Cosmopolite, one of my favourite parts of Moving Pictures, because she now seems to have accidentally formed a cult, and really I think that's what she deserves.
I don't think it's what she wants.
Well, no, but it's still nice for her. I'm glad some people appreciate the wisdom of Mrs. Cosmopolite. I myself follow the way of Mrs. Cosmopolite. But that
so
I mean...
Like,
I...
like, implications, Joanna, before you start flailing around with a broom again.
No, it's fine. The broom's outside. Bear Mountain.
Mm-hmm.
So-called because it's bear, not because it has a lot of bears, but no one's correcting the spelling.
Yes, this works better in text.
Yeah, this doesn't really work on the podcast. This is where the witches meet for the Sabbat. There's also, on that bit, a fun little footnote about how bird spelling can be dangerous, like the Seraph of Alibi cursed by a badly educated deity, and for days everything he touched turned to glod.
A small little glod
from Miller, yes. And these days the people of Alibi are renowned for being unusually short and bad-tempered.
Bear Mountain is in the larger area of the Ram Tops, of course.
Yeah, there's a lovely description as they're flying away from the Ram Tops. The tiny kingdom of Lanka occupied little more than a wide ledge cut into the side of the Ram Top Mountains. Behind it, knife-edge peaks and dark winding valleys climbed into the massive backbone of the central ranges. And in front, the land dropped abruptly to the Stow Plains, a blue haze of woodlands, a broader expanse of ocean, and somewhere in the middle of it all, a brown smudge known as Ankh Morpork. So this
is
one of the first bits of sort of, I think, bigger world building that we get.
Yeah, yeah.
There's some depiction of some of the shape of the world, obviously early in like Colour of Magic and when they're travelling, which we were following along with the map for a bit, but I don't currently have anywhere to hang the map up in my flat.
No, I did think about bringing the map out and trying to trace the witch's journey. I might do so next week.
Yeah, I might do for our final episode. But it's quite nice here to hear a sort of description of where the mountains are in relation to the plains and then to the city itself.
Yeah.
So I thought that was lovely. Where else? We've got the mine, which is fun because we're getting, again, more insight into dwarf culture.
Yeah.
But also the interesting thing about what's happening with dwarfs and good old-fashioned dwarfs. Most dwarfs were off earning big money in the cities down in the lowlands, where it's much easier to be a dwarf because you don't have to spend most of your time underground hitting your thumb with a hammer. And this is the first, I think, mention we'll see of something that becomes a fun theme, which is more and more dwarfs leaving the dwarf mines and underground cities and coming to the surface cities.
Yeah, yeah, because we kind of covered it with trolls.
Yeah, we've had trolls, especially in moving pictures, and there were dwarfs around as well.
Yeah. But yeah, it's becoming an emerging trend for dwarfs and trolls.
Yeah, and trolls are mentioned in that same thing as well. You know, trolls should stop wearing suits and walking upright and go back to living under bridges and jumping out and eating people.
Well, absolutely.
So there's also many of the more traditional dwarf tribes have no female pronouns, and the courtship of dwarfs is therefore very tactful.
Yeah.
And that's something we'll come back to again.
And we've come back to before.
Yes. This is one of the big things about dwarfs. There's also the fact that every mine has its own king.
Yes. The boss is head engineer.
Yes. There's a nice bit about dwarfs having 200 words for rock that ties in with it. It's often said Eskimos have 50 words for snow. And I just like the footnote of not often, but not all the time, but probably some people say, hey, those Eskimos, what are people? 50 words for snow. And much like dwarves, Eskimos don't have 50, well, yes. Inuit, I suppose, yes, is the more accurate term.
These days, of course.
Inuit is the much more accurate term, and no, there aren't 50 words for snow in the language. There just are a lot of words for lots of different kinds of snow.
Yes.
And same
Which
thing
makes sense.
Rocks.
Like, we've got lots of different types of words for rain in England.
Yes.
Because we need it. God damn, we need it.
It's not raining right now.
I've got the curtain closed, I don't know, for audio reasons, you understand.
Yes. And yes, so dwarves don't have a word for rock. They have lots of different words for lots of different types of rock, because that is the most thing for them.
Good. And
God, sorry, that was an awful sentence.
That is the most thing for them, Joanna. And another thing, which is not rock, but quite a lot like rock, is dwarf bread.
Yes, we're introduced to dwarf bread in this section.
Culinary tonight.
I'm assuming is kind of a piss take of like Lembas bread.
Yeah, you know, you said that last time, but I accidentally, when I was looking in The Hobbit, which was the wrong place to find invisible runes, but that's where I was looking, there's something called cram, which is like a crappy version of Lembas bread, which I think is what it is, because the dwarves were eating it in The Hobbit. However, I said that and I now realise it was made by the men of Dale and shared with the dwarves, but it's like, it's got similar properties to Lembas, except it's like they go on about how much it sticks in their throat.
Yeah.
So
whereas dwarf bread seems to be either. Dwarf bread seems to sustain people mostly by the fact that they just are willing to do anything other than eat dwarf bread, which is fair.
Yeah, I don't think none of it gets eaten, does it? No, it just gets traded with the dwarves in the end, yeah.
And trod on and sat on and...
Yes.
dunked in a river, which the dwarves eventually would be quite happy about.
Yeah.
So then we've also got the vampire-ish town, De Flabbergast.
That's not what it's called, though, is it?
No, there's a sign. No, I think the castle that the town is
beneath. Because there's some bats fly past the moon, and then Nanny says De Flabbergast.
Oh, I thought that was meant to be the name of the castle. I must have written that down wrong.
Because she wouldn't know what the name of the castle was, would she?
Well, if it had a sign.
Did it have a sign?
No, I think I confused myself there. Either way, De Flabbergast does not actually mean bat.
It doesn't.
No.
No, of course it wouldn't.
De Fledermaus.
Ah, well, close.
Which is also the name of a Strauss operette.
What does that mean, just flying mouse?
Yeah, I'm assuming so.
Yeah, good old German. yeah, I kind of thought it was a proto-Uberwald kind of thing.
Yeah.
So it's a Transylvania piston, isn't it? What's it called when it's a place that's meant to be like a mirror of the place? It's not an allegory, obviously. It's a...
Landagory.
yeah, why not? but yeah, so while I was looking at that, I noticed that, because it talked about the Sylvanian gloom, I was like, Sylvanian? I guess that means wooded then.
Yeah.
And I looked it up, and yeah, apparently Transylvania just meant like across the forest, or on the other side of the forest. And while I was finding that out, it used to have a much cooler name, because in medieval Latin, it was called Ultra Sylvania, which meant beyond the woods, so...
Ultra Sylvania is a really badass name. When we have a forest kingdom, we can call it Ultra Sylvania.
Yeah. And then Uberwald, of course, which we'll see later, is another play on that, but we can do that when we get there.
Yeah. But this is definitely sort of proto for a land we will get to later on.
Yeah.
And then obviously the big one that we start seeing is Genua, which is interesting. So Genua is a weird thing where it's like New Orleans with a magical fantasy kingdom dumped on top.
Yeah, because Pratchett said it was New Orleans was like Disneyland.
Yeah, there's a good quote from him I got from the annotator Pratchett. It had its genesis some years ago when I drove from Orlando to New Orleans and formed some opinions about both places. In one, you go there and fun is manufactured and presented to you. In the other, you just eat and drink and a lot of fun happens.
Yeah, that's nice.
So it is this sort of weird, like, Disneyland dumped on New Orleans situation.
Yeah, see, I didn't see the Disneyland bit until I found that quote. I was imagining... one of the old European city-states, like Venice, for instance, because it was going on about the quarrelling factions within it. But I'm sure there was inspiration drawn from a lot of places, but I do like where he got it from. It turns out that does work very well, doesn't it? Structured
especially,
fun never works.
No, structured fun is the... Organised fun is the devil.
Mandatory fun. Excellent album.
Yes, excellent album. Terrifying concept. So where are we? We are on to little bits that we liked.
We are. What do we like, Joanna?
Everything about this book is great.
Yeah.
But one of the things I really like is just the really quick humour of some bits. And I think this comes partly from the fact that we're into, like, as we said before, we're into mid-period Discworld and it's really established. And specifically with the witches, like, all the relationships have been established in a previous book. So you can really just be into it now.
Yeah.
Which allows for just... great little exchanges. You can tell it's just having fun with the double triple act of it all.
Yeah, this is like the real laugh out loud all the way through books, possibly the first one.
Yeah, this is one of the ones that just consistently makes me giggle. Some of my favorites involving Margaret Garlick standing there bifurcated, just as long as she got the young man's name and address.
Is it bifurcated or bifurcated?
Probably bifurcated. Look, I think, Phil, our listeners have accepted at this point that I will not say things correctly.
But anyway, ever since I read that a couple of weeks ago, every time I've seen myself in the mirror in trousers, I'll be like standing there bifurcated, honestly, because I love that very much.
There's also a follow-up line to that, which is, that's silly. That's like saying everyone's naked under their clothes. Granny says, Margaret, may you be forgiven. And then Granny says, well, I'm not. I've got three vests on.
And the bit about wash parts of myself as and when they become available.
Yeah, I just wash the bits as and when they become available, which is such a granny thing.
And then later on, when Nanny's like, "Don't talk to me about hygiene," when there's indoor toilets in somewhere they stay, just like these properly old-fashioned country old women who know hygiene very well, but it's just a little different from us.
I mean, yeah, I also just really fucking love old women. This is why so much of what I write is basically written for older women.
Yeah,
there's so much room for comedy.
Yeah, it's definitely, this kind of thing has brought me round to the inevitability of aging slightly more.
I can't wait to be one of these old, well, I can't wait to be Nanny Og, which is going to be Nanny Og without the clan when I grow up.
You make your own clan of little minions.
Oh yes, absolutely. And then there's lots of fun little references. This is something we'll come back to in each section. It gets heavier in the next few books, but there's lots of Lord of the Rings bits in this.
Yeah, this third especially, you've got which were your favourite ones?
Well, you've got the invisible runes on the dwarf door.
That was Lord of the Rings, wasn't it? Because I tried to find them in The Hobbit. There's some invisible keyhole in The Hobbit. But
no, it's in Fellowship of the Ring when they enter the Mines of Moria and they're stuck outside and can't work out what to do. Gandalf reveals the invisible runes over the door and it says, "Speak, friend, and enter."
That's it. Or "Open up, you little sods."
Yeah.
It's basically a synonym. Dialectical.
And the just whole discussion of, well, how do you know you've got proper invisible runes? Well, you can't see them.
Oh, yeah.
And then what was the other one? Oh, yeah, this is, they're in the boat and they're going down the river. And two pale glows appeared at the edge of the lamplight. And eventually they turned out to be the eyes of a small grey creature, vaguely frog-like, paddling towards them. And it pulls up to the side of the boat and says, "Hello, it's my birthday." And then Granny just hits it and it goes down the side.
There's the Hobbit.
Yeah, that's obviously meant to be Smeagol on his birthday.
Yeah, it's, I love how like complete and obvious that reference is, and like it's a big deal what it's referencing, and that it's just like smack with an awe.
Yeah.
Can't trust the slimy ones.
Basically, if that had happened in Lord of the Rings, it would have been a much shorter book.
Yeah, no.
And some would argue that The Lord of the Rings could stand to be a slightly shorter book.
Well, it was The Hobbit, wasn't it, that we had that scene? But it's my birthday.
Oh,
that's
wait.
When Bilbo gets his ring.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Yes.
Sorry, I'm thinking of Lord of the Rings and the film that have the flashback to when Smeagol finds the ring for the first time.
Ah, yes.
Because it's on his birthday.
Yes. Oh, now I'm sad.
Yeah. I want to watch Lord of the Rings again.
I don't. I want to reread The Hobbit. And then get sad about that. I'm getting sad about things at the moment, though.
Oh, I blame
this morning. I cried at "Black Tie" by Grace
Petrie. Oh, that song makes me cry like every time I listen to it.
Oh, okay, good. Not just me. Good.
Yeah,
yeah.
That's absolutely a tear-filled song.
I'm going to start making a list of random shit that's making me cry, so I can properly communicate like my slight worry at becoming a more emotional being.
I cried at a spoon for like a straight 10 minutes yesterday. So.
All right, cool. I'm fine then.
Yeah.
If I'm using you as my benchmark, which I'm sure is fine.
Oh, and then I put orange blossom water in my gin and tonic and cried for 5 minutes over that. Again.
Dude, are you okay?
Yeah. No, I'm fine. It's just it's a pandemic. I haven't been indoors with another human being in 3 weeks.
Yeah. Yeah. We'll go see each other outdoors again later. That'll be fine.
Yeah. Anyway.
So.
What hasn't made me cry is folk songs.
Yet.
I mean, they are somewhat eye-watering.
So bluebirds and such, I'm assuming you're on about?
Yes, well, there's a lovely dedication at the beginning of this book, actually, dedicated to all those people who, after the publication of Weird Sisters, deluged the author with their versions of the Hedgehog song.
Yes. Which, you can tell he's slightly baffled by it. And why not?
We won't be singing that on the podcast again.
We will not.
Although in future, I may bust out my ukulele for future songs given to us by Nanny, because she is a gift.
The gift that keeps on giving in very unsuitable ways.
She is actually a delight, not a delight in the way I describe myself.
A delight.
But I just love Granny's dislike of them, because, you know, you think you're listening to a nice song about cuckoos and nightingales and...
It sounds like she's referencing a particular one. Did you look into that?
I had a quick look at the annotated Pratchett, and there's quite a few different silly folk songs that's sort of referenced. There's lots of traditional ones that involve walking out on a May morning and spying a maiden.
Oodalali, oodalali, etc.
Do, 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 do.
I added that to my Disney playlist recently. Excellent choice.
I haven't watched that in forever.
Now, yeah, that would be a good rewatch because it's been very, very many years, and that was possibly my first confusing cartoon crush.
For context, for any listeners who don't know what we're talking about, we mean the animated Robin Hood, where we were all weirdly attracted to a cartoon fox.
If you didn't get that from the three hummed notes we did there, I don't know how to help you, frankly.
But I think that is...
Sorry. What were you saying? That
I think a lot of people had confusing crushes on that cartoon fox.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
Anyway, sorry, what about garlic?
Garlic, Joanna. One of the little bits I liked was the fact that this vampire-ridden town had, by necessity, started a very garlic-heavy culinary tradition.
Mm-hmm.
And although they were thoroughly sick of it by the time they were able to get rid of it, I wondered if you had any recommendations of insanely garlic-heavy meals, because, you know, I rather like an inappropriate amount of garlic. Although I do not, I would like to make this clear, eat garlic sausage in bed.
I am
boots
not
on or off, fine, but no sausages.
So I live above a Polish grocer that sells very, very good garlic sausage. So I am not going to say that I've never eaten garlic sausage in bed.
I think for research purposes, you might have to deliberately eat some garlic sausage in bed before next week.
Okay. Do I have
to boots on?
I'm going to have to film this for the listeners, aren't I?
Sure. We'll have a podcast only fans. Why not?
I've got to figure out the least sexy way possible to film myself eating sausage.
I'm not sure there is a sexy way to do what we're planning, Joe.
That could be said about so many of our endeavours.
How did we get here? Garlic recommendations, garlic, please, Joanna.
The restaurant I work in, we get like huge kilo bags of pre-peeled garlic because we get through so much of it, which meant I took loads home when we had to. So I had to do some using up lots. So I really like roasting garlic, either peeled cloves or whole bulbs, and then just cutting off and squeezing out the puree and mixing that with butter and keeping that in the freezer. So I've always got some roasted garlic butter.
That's a good idea.
Yeah. Also, I made doom. Which is, doom is the Arabic word for garlic, but it's also the name for a particular garlic sauce.
D-H-U-M or?
T-O-U-M.
Okay.
And it is amazing. So you just blitz loads of garlic with lemon juice and salt and then add oil really slowly. And it comes up with it's like aioli, but without the egg.
Yeah, I was going to say, yeah, ooh.
It emulsifies and becomes this like mayonnaise-like texture, but that tastes like kebab shop garlic sauce basically, and it's completely vegan because you're adding egg to it.
What kind of food processor thingy is it? Just a blender?
Have like a tiny little blender thing. You just need something you can pour in the oil as you go. You can even do it by hand if you really, really finely mince the garlic with salt, whisk it with lemon, and then add the oil slowly while whisking. It's just that hurts like fuck on your wrist.
Yeah, I've got a little electric whisk as well.
Yeah.
So
it's a lengthy process because it has to really break down to emulsify. But the sauce is amazing. And because it's vegan and it's just garlic suspended in oil, it lasts ages.
Well, talking to you does get me over my cooking fatigue temporarily.
I get very excited about this. So, yeah. So those are some of my favourite uber garlicky things. And, I'll get some garlic sausage to eat in bed.
Thank you very much. That little bit I liked was mainly just an excuse to ask for recipes. So thank you. the second bit I liked was not an excuse to ask you for advice because it's about jumpstarting a car.
Which I have never had to do because I don't drive.
I haven't had to yet. I'm terrified of when I do because I don't really know how. But so Granny's Broom almost could have been a character, and I nearly suggested it until I noticed how many characters we already had.
Yeah, it was originally. I cut it out for brevity's sake.
But because I remembered it was borrowed originally, wasn't it? So it was Hilter's.
Yes.
Broomstick in equal rights. So I think $2 later, we can assume she's not giving it back.
Yeah.
Magrat, like, running up and down trying to start it and get it neutral and everything. You can tell, like, it comes from practice experience with old cars because he's got, like, a mechanical background anyway. And I expect he has done this with lots of different things. They called it, what did they call it? Hump starting in the books. But obviously bump starting is when you push a vehicle downhill and like you have to engage the clutch like right at the right speed and then it starts the engine. I think generally these days you do it if everything else has failed, but I imagine
with all the cars that would break down quite a lot, that would happen quite a lot.
Yeah. So you think of some like old-fashioned movies, TV shows, whatever, you get people pushing cars along quite a lot, don't you?
Yeah. It happens in the opening to Karate Kid, which I watched for the first time recently. I just love the mental image of not just Margaret doing it, but Margaret trying to explain to this town full of very friendly, very happy people who don't speak a word of English.
And realizing how stupid she sounded.
Yeah. Which is the thing. Do you just sort of do it, or do you speak while you're doing it? So even though they don't understand your explanation, they know you are explaining it.
I feel like I'm like Magrat, and I will try and over-explain and just make it weirder.
Yeah.
I don't like how much myself I see in Magrat.
Yeah, ditto. I feel like I'm
it's
less
an uncomfortable
Magrat.
Read.
I'm less Magrat now than I used to be, but I definitely have Magrat-like tendencies.
Definitely. Later in the book, where we get some like fantastic theories and quotes and things, like, I'm happy to say I'm definitely more like the other two than I am like Magrat these days. But just when it comes to the general awkwardness. Yeah.
I'm a social Margaret. I only Margaret socially.
Social Margaret, philosophical granny, sexual nanny. not me.
Yeah, I would say I'm like two-thirds nanny with a bit of Margaret, and I would like to be quite Granny Weatherwax, but honestly, I'm just never going to be that level of confident. So speaking of witches, onto the bigger stuff, the actual nature of witchcraft and how it all works.
All right, flat down, that's a bit of a jump. Now we've got the broom started.
There's a few different bits about it I like, but what I find interesting is near the beginning, when they're having the Sabbat.
Oh, yeah.
And they're discussing the fact that these witches have boundaries and territories and areas they work for. And this is this very slow burn world building. This is the first time I think that is how the witches operate. This is the first time that's mentioned.
That's a really good point, because when I read that bit, I was only thinking about the fact that it was making the same reference about men writing things about women dancing naked. Yes. And I giggled at that. But yeah, no, I completely missed that. Yeah, this is the first bit of...
And this is an interesting... Admin. Yeah, we actually see witchy admin, and I quite like that.
Yeah.
And the fact that there's the conflict of dominant personalities in a group of witches, because they're all used to being in charge.
It's like tigers or something, isn't it, with these massive territories, and obviously it just would not naturally get along very well together.
Yeah, but they are intelligent enough to do a bit of admin.
Yeah.
But I just like that, you know, they have got some kind of organisational system with people having different areas, because it's something that's sort of alluded to, with the fact that Granny lives where she does and Nanny lives down into the town, and Margaret has another cottage further off that she inherited from Goody Wemper.
Yeah. And they might have said something like her patch or something in the last one. But he's actually gone, oh, actually, let's lay this out, because this is quite fun.
So, yeah, I like that we're getting this sort of, this is the joy of doing a series that is this long, like, except we're on book 12, is that you get the really slow burn world building.
Yeah. And although it is kind of an admin thing, it's a really good plot device, isn't it? Because in this one, like, it's relevant because Margaret takes over
Desiderata's job.
Thank you, Desiderata's job, yeah. And then in other books, it becomes relevant again. And yeah.
Yeah. So it's a lovely thing. And then some of the other stuff about just the nature of witchcraft. There's a very good line about not using magic. When the witches are left alone to deal with this mind collapse, and Nanny says... if the creator had meant us to shift rocks by witchcraft, he wouldn't have invented shovels. Knowing when to use a shovel is what being a witch is all about.
Yes.
And this is the magic of not doing.
Although in this case, shovels would not do the job.
No, and this is why pumpkins end up happening. I also just quite like the throwaway, put down that wheelbarrow, Margaret. You don't know anything about machinery.
Yeah, so I'm fucking patronising.
And Margaret's frustration with their attitude as well. This is a few pages later. And she, you know, Margaret, it does get frustrated at the way the witches speak to her, understandably.
Yeah.
And she's thinking about the fact that it doesn't seem like they bother. They're not committed to witchcraft in the same way she is, because this is Margaret of the occult symbols and the mystical knives. Yeah. But she's still sensible enough. You know, we have at the end of Weird Sisters, she shoves the bread knife in her boot because she does know.
Yeah.
But Margaret knows she's very good at herbs and can double distill and do all these wonderful things, whereas Nanny just gives people a hot poultice and Granny just gives them some colour liquid. And Margaret is so frustrated because that works.
Yeah, yeah.
And she has put all of this effort into it. So to see that actually it works in a much simpler way.
It's almost like any profession or any craft where you do have to put a lot more effort in at the start.
Yeah.
And you see, like, taking writing, for instance, you get people who try and write like Hemingway from the beginning and they almost always sound like shit.
Yeah.
Because Ernest Hemingway could write like that because he knew how to write and then he worked out how to hone it down.
Exactly.
So I'm guessing, like, Nanny and Granny had to learn all the basics as well. And perhaps they weren't as, like, airy-fairy as Margaret about it. But I'm sure they worked until they whittled it down to the equivalent of one or two lines.
Exactly. And it's a bit like you get it with cooking as well. When you start out, you learn very much the proper way to do things, which is often the French way. And so I learned, especially like with the head chef I've got now, we quite often do things in a much simpler way. And it's like, yes, it is not the proper, correct and traditional way, but it takes half the time and you can't tell the fucking difference.
Yeah. So in that sense, it is the correct way.
Yeah.
And you know what the outcome should be. And so you therefore can approach it from different directions.
Yes. And this is the thing. Granny and Nanny know what the outcome should be and they know what they're doing works, whereas Margaret is still at the stage of learning all of it.
Yeah. And you can sympathise from both ends because you can see why Granny and Nanny are kind of a bit dismissive because they've got other things to be thinking about and higher-minded, and you've got this, let's be honest, bit of a wet hen following alongside.
Yes.
But then, obviously, they are being dicks.
They are being dicks, and then from Margaret's point of view, it's like, why do I have to put so much work in if they're getting results the same way? They're not doing it properly.
Yeah.
And that can be very frustrating to watch.
It can, yeah. No, I like that.
As we reflect on that, should we...
Good segue.
About mirrors.
Good. Well done. Segway. I was trying to think of something. You got that? Mirrors. Oh, do you know what I was saying last night? I'm trying to learn about something scientific about this, about power of mirrors. Because like in the science of Discworld, it referenced something called interferometry, which like includes mirrors used in telescopes and things. So I'm going to get back to that. Hopefully I'll have something coherent before the end of the book, because as previously mentioned, struggle a little bit with physics. So in the meantime, do you remember the first time you saw yourself like in infinity mirrors and that kind of...
I don't remember the first time.
Oh, do you remember playing with it as a kid?
I do. I remember, I have a very specific memory of the guest room at my grandmother's house up north.
Yeah.
Had this big antique dresser with a huge mirror on it. And then there was a really ornate hand mirror. And I would sit for hours and play with the hand mirror reflecting on the big antique mirror on the edge of the bed because it was up north and I was bored.
Everyone I've asked has a really specific memory like that. So Jack remembered if he opened the bathroom cabinet in like the house he lived in before he was 10, he could do that. And I remember going to my grandma's friend's house and always sitting in her vanity and arranging it so I could do that. Like, so readers, no, the other ones, listeners, please write in and tell us yours, because my current sample size is very small.
Yeah. If you could all tell us your early memories of seeing yourself between two mirrors, that would be great.
Yeah. But yeah, the other mirror stuff that comes up, I just noticed on page 30, Granny, as she looks at the covered mirror in Desiderata's living
cottage,
yeah. She makes a comment about not knowing that Desiderata was frightened of thunderstorms. So I looked into that, and it seems to be a fairly widespread but pretty old-fashioned, as in it's dying out a little bit, belief. The mirrors attract thunderstorms to a house.
Oh, right.
So if it was raining or if, like, a storm might be coming, you'd cover or even take down the mirrors. So I found references from a lot of South America, Brazil and El Salvador. And then also, which might be relevant, I'm not sure, it's also a belief in the Creole culture a lot around Louisiana. And obviously, because this ties in with New Orleans.
Yeah.
However, I also have a feeling, although I can't find a primary source, that it was also a belief in Europe.
Yeah, I can imagine that was probably an English folk belief.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think that might be a reference to that. Also, you should also cover a mirror after death in the house, apparently, to avoid the spirit getting trapped in there. So when Desiderata hung up on Lilith, that did have a dual purpose.
Ah.
Yeah. That's my mirror things for today. There's so much more on mirrors in the next few books. I did try when it described Lilith's room, and there's like an octagon of mirrors, and then there's the like he describes it in detail so much that I feel like I should be able to build a simulation thing in one of these free programs, and I ran out of time and it's difficult, so I might send you a link and get you to do it for me.
I would quite like to have a look at that, actually. That could be quite fun.
Yeah, because it's a really cool description of like the octagon of mirrors and open to the sky, and obviously there's just a shit ton of folklore surrounding mirrors, so I fell down that rabbit hole fairly extensively.
I would say not a folklore thing, but something I've noticed that's been quite good for my mental health is I no longer have a mirror above my sink in my bathroom. My bathroom has a pretty weird layout, so it's on the opposite wall, which means I just very rarely look in my bathroom mirror because I don't have any cause to be looking at that bit
of wall. So you choose to look at it, if you want
and
to.
And just not being confronted with my own face first thing in the morning is really quite good.
Yeah, I can see that. I've been thinking about taking mine down because, just because like I'm a skin picker, and if I give myself a chance and it's right there, then it's more likely to happen. So I could just move it.
It's not that I dislike my face or anything. It's just that I don't necessarily want to acknowledge my own existence first thing.
No, well, yeah, I don't feel particularly benevolent towards anything first thing. So it's unlikely my face is going to be the exception.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So ties us back into our early discussion of how it feels to wake up in the morning.
Although my hair is at that length now where it doesn't look too bad in the morning, which is nice.
My hair,
this will last maybe another week.
My hair is at that length where it looks the way it looks.
Yes.
Any time
of day.
Which
is good. I like it.
There's a lot of it. So
Power of stories.
I don't have a segue for that.
No.
This is the big thing, and I'm going to talk about this in every section of the book because I love it, and this is why I love this book so much. The whole thing that I bring up almost every book, this narrative causality idea.
Yes, and this is the book where he gets to play with it throughout the whole thing. Yeah,
it's like he's been generating those building blocks for himself in the last 11 books, and now he's like, right, I'm going to play in the sandpit. That's a mix the metaphors up
cool,
a bit
cool,
there.
Cool, yeah.
Stories, great flapping ribbons of shaped space-time have been blowing and uncoiling around the universe since the beginning of time. And their very existence overlays a faint but insistent pattern on the chaos that is history. Stories etch grooves deep enough for people to follow in the same way that water follows certain paths down a mountainside. And it sort of says, you know, once a story is started, it takes shape and it picks up all the vibrations of that story. So history repeats. 1,000 heroes have stolen fire from the gods and 1,000 wolves have eaten grandmother.
And there's like a footnote on urban myths as well, isn't there?
Yes, which I had to look up because I actually don't know a lot of common urban myths in there. Dead grandmothers whisked away on the reef racks of stolen cars.
Yeah.
Which is an urban myth about people whose grandmother dies on a journey. So they tie to the reef rack and then the car gets stolen.
Oh,
loyal Alsatians choking on the fingers of midnight burglars, which is the thing. People go out and they come home and their dog's choking and it's fingers, so it's a burglar whose hand they've bitten off. Those are the two main ones it references.
Yeah.
The last one, my brood husband will be livid. It was his travel module, and this is sort of a thing about two people having sex in a car and having to get assistance to be taken out of it because the lock stuck or something, and then the woman saying, oh, my husband will be livid, it was his car.
Oh yeah. You're Wrong About has a really good episode on urban myths, which I will recommend.
Oh cool. Yeah, so urban myths, I feel like I've skipped over the wrong part of time. Like I feel like urban myths have fallen by the wayside in place of like things like creepypasta for us. I haven't lived in the bit of the world where there was a lack of internet and check to see how many times this story has been told.
Yeah. Like we've probably heard a few urban myths in the pubs before smartphones were a thing, but you're right.
It's less of a thing now.
Yeah. If someone comes up to one of us and said, oh, you never guess what happened over Stowe Market Way, we'd be like, no shit. Bring out the phone, try and find the news article. Yeah.
Man door hook car hand.
Yeah. Yeah, the less specific ones, obviously, are the general structures of stories.
Exactly. And the fairy tale-ness of this, it really fascinates me. I'm really obsessed with fairy tales and stories and why we tell the stories we tell so much, why we tell the happily ever afters and the handsome prince rescuing us. And then obviously I've written a lot about it and about the side characters of those stories. And so one of my favourite things I've ever written is the monologue, The Crone.
Yeah.
Which I kind of regret not organising a radio play version of for this, but we will do it for a later book.
Yes.
I haven't actually spoken to the actor about it, but she listens to this. So, hi, Helen, I'm going to need you. Thanks.
This is how I'll be doing all of my communications from now. If you don't listen to the podcast, it's entirely your fault if you don't turn up for the meetings.
But yeah, this idea of the maiden, the mother, and the other one.
Yeah, yeah.
And that was fun because I was writing about what it is to be the other one and to have had to live through all these stories and live through this entire cycle.
Yeah.
And how women become treated very differently as the stories move on, whereas men basically get to go from prince to king.
Yeah.
And then, I don't know, die eventually.
Yeah.
Whereas women quite often become villains as they get older.
Yeah.
I just like the inescapable nature of stories, the fact that you will find yourself falling into it, whether you like it or not. And I like kind of looking for the weird narrative causality moments in my own life. Like, we were joking, you, I, and another friend had gone for, of course, socially distanced for our coffee outside. And I was wearing a hat that kept blowing away. And we said, well, if there was any narrative causality, a handsome man with a dog would rescue the hat for me and have to jump in a river.
Yeah.
Still very annoyed that hasn't happened. But I do keep wearing fetching hats on windy days just in case.
And it's interesting that we're all kind of subconsciously aware of the structure of stories, even if we couldn't vocalise it. So like when you watch a TV show and you know what's going to happen next, because of course that's what's going to happen next. And then occasionally you get the show where it doesn't, and then it catches you by surprise, and those are the very good ones.
Yeah.
But if you're watching, if comfort watching, like Modern Family, something like that, you're like, and this is going to happen, and this is going to happen, and that's fine. Like,
and that's an interesting thing, whereas for so much of humanity, these same stories were told over and over again, these same myths, the myths of hubris that come from Greek mythology, and the myths of trust that come from Norse mythology, and then the myths of fairy tales that develop, especially from the Germanic influence, and that becomes these dark, horrible stories that then get Disneyfied and prettified. Whereas I think now, in a much more modern age, the stories that we all know and that we all can spot happening over and over again are kind of those things like sitcom structures.
Yeah.
And we know the hero's journey from movies and from TV series. So where we see a story, we spot this should be a rom-com moment. I should walk into someone with a cup of coffee, or a handsome man with a dog should rescue my hat. And I think it's quite fascinating to look at how narrative causality changes in like a modern time.
Yeah. Yes. It's probably that we get to watch or hear or read a lot more stories as well than you might have done a long time ago, because we're not relying on one person's memory or very expensive books, and we've got the television. You know, I'll sit here and binge watch 16, 20-minute stories in a row.
Yeah.
So we possibly got more of a sense of narrative causality than we would have done a few hundred years ago.
Yeah, but I think to circle it back around to the book and specifically the fairy tale of it all, you know, they're immediately confused by the fact that what they need to do is stop someone from marrying a prince, because that's not what the story should be.
Yes.
And of course it has to be three of them, even though Margaret thinks it should just be her, because stories, things come in threes.
Yeah.
And there are all these little elements of the book itself setting you up for this is going to be a story. Mm-hmm. And because it's a story about the nature of stories, you really know it's going to be.
So meta.
And yeah, it is very meta, because then what you end up getting is a beautiful story that defies expectations of every turn. But all of these expected stories happening within it, like
it's referencing the things it's not doing at the same time as then showing them,
like the vampire being defeated.
Yeah.
So it's why I love the book. It's why I think it's such a lovely book.
Yeah, it is great. In my memory, it was just one of the funniest, and it is interesting to reread with a slightly different lens on.
Do you have an obscure reference, Finial, for me, Francine?
Yeah, it's the end of the quote you were saying about the stories flapping about, to put it far less beautifully.
Oh, those flapping stories.
It says it takes a special kind of person to fight back and become the bicarbonate of history. So I was kind of imagining, like, you know, when you put bicarb of soda and vinegar together, I was imagining like a violent reaction almost, like being the spanner in the works almost. But then having looked into it slightly, I think he's probably referencing bicarbonate as a neutralizer, like you know, bicarbonate's like an electrolyte in your body.
Yeah.
Which your kidneys give out and absorb, and it maintains blood pH. So it kind of keeps things neutral and stops things from going to the extreme. And I'm wondering if that's what it means. Like the bicarbonate of history is to be the calm the fuck down person.
Yeah, I like that.
I don't know. It could be either way. What do you think?
I think that you've just reminded me I needed to put bicarb on my shopping list.
Cool, cool. Well, listeners, please please write in with your shopping lists and opinions. Send us your opinions. Send us your shopping lists. Send Tesco your opinions.
Other supermarkets are available.
Well, Joanna, I think that's a good place to wrap it up.
Yes. So next week we'll be back with part two of Which is Abroad. I don't know when that's going to end yet. We will let you know when we know. I'll tweet it. I always say that. I never remember to tweet it. Anyway, thank you very much for listening to The Two Shall Make You Fret. If you enjoyed this podcast, please rate us, review and subscribe and things wherever you get your podcast, because it helps other people find us. Please tell people about us. I think the world needs to know. We're a few weeks away from recording our Christmas/Hogswatch special.
Yeah.
So please, if you have any letters for the Hogfather,
Try and be a slightly better actor than last year.
I don't know what you're talking about. That was all legit. If you've got any letters for the Hogfather, if you've got any letters or questions for us, anything you want to hear us talk about, Discworld or otherwise, please get in touch so that we have some content. If you would like,
frankly, the 40-odd books of the Discworld is not enough for us.
Yes. But yes, we want to hear from you, especially
for Christmas. We want your mutterings.
So if you would like to get in touch with us, there's many ways you can follow us on Instagram at The True Show Make You Fret. You can find us on Twitter at Make You Fret Pod, Facebook, The True Show Make You Fret. You can find us on Reddit, r/TTSMYF. And of course, you can email us your letters to the Hogfather, thoughts, queries, castle snacks, and albatrossipods.
And Australian ice creams.
And Australian ice creams. The True Shall Make Ye Fret Pod at gmail.com.
Huzzah.
And in the meantime, dear listener, don't let us detain you.
Anyway,
sorry.
Please don't let me keep talking. Say something.